Everyone in the world's here.
Everyone and their moms and their cousins and their cousins
and their
cousins'
fishes.
Yeah, are they all here for Beyonce? This is insane.
Are you about that cello life or what?
Yeah.
Cello? Can I get a cello? Can I get a bro-cello?
Ah, Coachella, music, sun, fun, social media, lots to be excited about. But there is a dark side to the music festival. Most women are familiar with it. Groping, harassment, it happens a lot. And we'll talk with a journalist who chronicled all the harassment and the experience that she had at Coachella last weekend. That's coming up. But first, California is the center of the Trump resistance, right? Right. But not all of Californians are on board. Actually, about half. That's right. Half of Californians favor President Trump's infamous travel ban. Many are against sanctuary policies. This from a new UC Berkeley survey of residents across the state. Jack Pitney is a professor of American politics at Claremont McKenna College. He's a former Republican strategist. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Well, okay, so according to the survey done from Berkeley's Haas Institute for a Fair and Inclusive Society, half of the respondents support the president wanting to temporarily ban people from majority Muslim countries, and a quarter of the respondents say it is very important to increase deportations of undocumented immigrants. Are you surprised by those findings?
Not entirely. One, in California, there has long been at least some strain of skeptical attitude toward undocumented immigrants and hostility toward people from Muslim countries. After all, it wasn't that far in the past that California voters enacted Proposition 187. But we have to take these findings with several grains of salt. Most people, most of the time, are not thinking very hard about political issues. And if you drill down, I think one would find that if you explain the issues in greater detail to people, you might get different results.
Right. And some of the other findings do have or show different results. They, for example, more than 70% favor establishing a pathway to citizenship. And they say that is somewhat or very important. And nearly 80% want citizenship for Dreamers. So, again, there's some contradiction there.
This is actually a classic pattern in public opinion research. People have long found that American attitudes are not very consistent over a whole range of issues because, again, most of the time they're just not thinking in any great detail about the issues, so they may react to a particular word. For example, in terms of the ban on immigrants from Muslim countries, they may have heard that one of the countries is Somalia. Well, Somalia is an extremely troubled country, and if Americans and Californians have heard any news from Somalia, it's probably bad. So they may be reacting to that and not really thinking through the deeper constitutional issues that are involved here.
So you're saying we're easily swayed?
We have to be very careful in reading poll results. People may be reacting to the particular wording of the particular question, and it doesn't necessarily reflect what their deliberative opinion would be.
What would reflect that? Actual voting on a particular issue, like a ballot measure, like 187, for example?
Well, in some cases, ballot measures are even worse because it's a binary choice and people may be reacting to very limited information. One thing, and some research has been done on this, the use of deliberative polling, that is, where people have an opportunity to discuss issues, where issues are explained in much greater detail than was possible in a survey like this, and you too tend to get different results in that case.
But in that case, aren't they perhaps swayed by the way the questions are framed or the way the discussion is monitored and guided?
That's the perennial problem with public opinion research. You're trying to tease out something that is only partially there. So the best way to do it is simply to provide people with more information. But even there, as you say, the information is sometimes freighted with political significance. So watch how people act in real life. Watch how people deal with immigrants on a day-to-day basis. And that is perhaps a sure sign of what they're really feeling.
So this gets to a big question that we are grappling with probably more now than we have in the recent past. And that is, where is the middle these days in California or even the rest of the country?
That depends on where you are. I suspect if you were to take a poll like this in Alabama, the differences would be pretty stark. In California, I think there is probably still a significant strain of anti-immigrant sentiment, not as strong as it was when the state passed Proposition 187, but it's there. However, I think that Californians' attitudes toward immigrants are more tolerant than they are in many other parts of the country, in part because Californians have a great deal of experience on a day-to-day basis from people not only from Mexico, but from other countries as well.
Jack Pitney, professor of American politics at Claremont McKenna College. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why women who go to Coachella can expect to be sexually harassed, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Coachella's second weekend kicks off tomorrow. All the staples will be there. Overpriced beer, throngs of young people in various states of dress, Beyonce, and unfortunately, the likelihood, if you're a woman, of sexual harassment. Vera Papasova is an editor at Teen Vogue. She was at Coachella last weekend. She says she spoke to more than 50 women there, and every one of them said they'd been sexually harassed. And Vera joins us now. Hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, you yourself were sexually harassed at Coachella. What happened?
Yeah, well, I was just walking around looking for people to talk to, and I was also trying to enjoy a few shows. There were a lot of great bands I wanted to see, and just at different points, I was groped a lot, and guys would just say things to me.
Yeah.
So I became part of my own story by accident. I didn't even really expect it.
Right. Well, so in similar stories from the, what, it was like 54 women you talked to?
Yeah.
And the groping was like what in nature? Was it when you're like pressed up against someone or someone was pressed up against you as you're watching a band or what?
Yeah, I think the most common, honestly, scenario is when you're at a concert and you're dancing. So you're in the crowd and you're dancing, and there's this thing that happens where there will be someone, you'll feel someone pretty close behind you. And if you start dancing, you will end up kind of like dancing against their body. And that's usually when someone will put their hands on like your hip, like my hips or my butt. And so that's kind of the most common. So when I wasn't reporting and I was trying to enjoy the shows, that's when the majority of the gropes happen. But also just, you know, in general on the field grounds, walking around or being in line, there were times I was just touched.
Just randomly by a stranger, just touched.
Yeah, I mean, it's crowded, so you're going to be walking through, and there's a difference between, like, sometimes it's accidental. I wouldn't count something that wasn't definitely on purpose, but I would count it if it was, like, someone squeezed, like, my side or if someone squeezed my butt. There was a lot of butt squeezing. There was one time I was actually standing in line, and I was in the artist compound, which is behind the stages where all the artists are, and I was waiting in line at the bathroom trailers. And this guy came up to me and he complimented my outfit. And then I was like, thank you, because also I loved my outfit too. And then he immediately was like, I'd love to get in a stall with you. Like, that was the next thing that he said.
The bathroom stall?
Yes.
Oh, that's pretty forward.
Yes.
Yeah. What did you say?
I said, don't talk to me like that. And he was visibly upset. And then he laughed at me and said, whoa, that's a lot of sass for like a no-name model.
Oh, great. And one of the stories was particularly shocking in your story. You interview this 19-year-old named Chantal, and she says she's really small, so this happens mm-hmm. to her a lot. A guy mm-hmm. picked me up, she says, and put me over his shoulder.
Yeah, that's actually not the first. She's not the only person who told me something like that. She was actually with a couple of her friends, I remember, and they were all around the same height, and they were all agreeing with her when she was saying that, you know, because I'm small, this happens a lot. And actually, two other girls who I interviewed, there was a 15-year-old and a 16-year-old, they were talking about how because they're small, you know, they are afraid that they might get, like, picked up by some guy who's bigger than they are. And that's something they expect to happen.
That's really scary.
Yeah.
Speaking of scary, does it go beyond the occasional, you know, not the occasional, the regular butt grab and vile comment? I mean, does it get into the realm of actual sexual assault?
Yeah, I think that that's kind of the problem, too, is that especially if you're alone, guys will just straight up say something like, oh, do you want to go back to my hotel room? And then it's putting you in a situation where, and I felt this way, I feel like scared to reject someone's invitation. And it's kind of scary to be alone in that situation, because if they get angry, that's when you're worried that it might escalate and become more violent. And that's something that happens outside of music festivals. Like, it's not just Coachella, it's not just music festivals, it's not even just parties. It's scary to basically be kind of outwardly rude when someone says something like that to you sometimes, because you just don't want them to hurt you mm-hmm. if they get mad at you mm-hmm. for saying no.
So here you have this mix of a lot of young people, a lot of probably drugs and alcohol, the music, the heat, people pressed close to together, this kind of spirit of hedonism, which seems to be encouraged on a certain level. Does all that factor into this behavior at Coachella and maybe at other music festivals?
I think that, you know, it's the same as like a college party. I think it's that environment of, you know, it's super crowded. I think a lot of people feel like they can get away with it because it's crowded and it's hard to pinpoint who's doing what. I think there is sort of, like you said, like an invitation. I think I question that in the story. Like, do they see this music festival or any kind of like large celebration or any kind of big party even? Do they feel like it's an invitation to sort of come in and prey on women? And I mean, I have that as a question. I don't know. I'm not in their head, but I do think that when it is really crowded, I feel especially helpless. And I definitely, you know, in reporting this story, I was walking around alone and I didn't even want to go back on Sunday, because just walking around alone in that festival environment just made me so uncomfortable. And I honestly had a really hard time reporting it, because I really didn't expect to have such a bad experience so many times. Mm. And so I went back on Sunday I wanted to make sure I got as many quotes as I could. And, you know, I ended up seeing Odessa, and they were great. And, you know, nothing happened to me at their show, and that was really fun. But, yeah, I mean, I definitely, by the end of the weekend, was just, like, pretty anxious the entire time I was walking around the festival grounds. And I think there's something too about just being by yourself. Like, I felt like I'm totally unsafe right now because I'm by myself and I'm a woman. And a lot of the people I interviewed, these young women, talked about the importance of never getting separated and being alone. And I think that, you know, my question is, like, do men feel that way? Do men feel like they can't walk around a music festival by themselves because they are unsafe? And I don't know, that maybe there are some men who do feel that way, because it's not just, I don't think this just happens to women. I just happen to only talk to women for this story. But yeah, I definitely think there is something about festival culture, which is why that makes people feel like they can get away with more. And that's why I think we need to, you know, figure out how we can work together to change it.
So what should Coachella be doing to prevent this behavior, or at least highlight it and make people aware of it?
So, I mean, I've been thinking about that so much. And I've looked up what other music festivals have done. Actually, someone at Bonnaroo reached out to me and said there's, you know, going to be like a safe space for women on the grounds. I know that there's a festival called Lightning in a Bottle, and they actually train their staff on sexual assault and harassment, and they have medics who are professionally trained in sexual assault scenarios. I've heard that there have been instances of, like, police officers being undercover and just like acting as bystanders. I don't know what exactly works. There's not like data that shows what stops sexual assault from happening because, like I said, it's complex. But I do think that it would be cool to see how Coachella uses their resources to make a difference. Like, I would love to see how they can sort of help shift the festival culture.
Yeah. And then in the meantime, as this weekend approaches, what do you think women should do?
Well, I want to be very clear when I say I don't think women should do anything. I don't think it's our responsibility to...
But how should they, you know, protect themselves if they, you know, what's the best way to try to prevent this from happening to them?
There isn't one. I mean, you can stay inside forever. Mm-hmm. I think that's really the only answer. I think young women should be able to go to music festivals and have fun. We should be able to go to parties and have fun. I should be able to go see David Byrne and take a picture of him and not get my butt grabbed. And I can't really tell you what I could do. You know, when I was there, I told security, and their security was super nice. But when those things happen and it's dark out or like you're in a crowded place, there's not much they can do, especially if you can't really describe what the person looked like. Or even if you can, I described the guy who said he wanted to get in the bathroom stall with me. The guy was really apologetic and he was like, thank you for telling me, but I have no idea if they found him later. What we could be talking about is what can other guys be doing to, you know, stop it from happening. Like, you know, there are different things that people can do when they're bystanders, but mm-hmm. There's no way to prevent it from happening to you.
Vera Papasova is wellness editor at Teen Vogue, and she runs the publication's sexual assault awareness campaign. It's called #NotYourFault. Vera, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Vera reached out to Coachella for comment, and she got no reply. We did the same. Also, no reply so far. We'll bring it to you if they do respond. Coming up, what happens after two teenage sisters decide to leave their home in Norway to join ISIS?
They thought that this was what would make God happy, what would make Allah happy, and what would make him the most happy was if they died as martyrs.
Two sisters, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In October of 2013, a man named Sadiq opened an email from his two daughters, Ayan and Layla. It said, "Muslims are under attack from all quarters and we need to do something. Sitting home and sending money is no longer enough. With this in mind, we have decided to travel to Syria and help out down there as best we can." Ayan was 19. Layla was 16. Originally from Somalia, they grew up in Norway, granted refugee status, and were living a normal life in a quiet neighborhood. When their dad got that email, he got on a plane and chased after his daughters, first to Turkey, and then into the violent mayhem that is the Syrian civil war. It really sounds like a Hollywood movie, but it's a real-life story of pain, anger, humiliation, and endless unanswered questions, chief among them, why would they do this? Norwegian journalist Åsne Seierstad wrote about this in her new book. It's called Two Sisters, A Father, His Daughters, and Their Journey into the Syrian Jihad. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first, tell us a little bit about this family when they were in Norway, because the girls were really young, right? When they came from Somalia, they were 6 and 3. How did they fit in?
They fitted in quite well, at least that's how it seemed on the surface. They were doing well in school, they had lots of friends, and they were doing sports, and they went to the beach and swimming, so they lived a life a bit like their Norwegian friends. And then things happened when they became teenagers, because in this family of five kids after a while, a mother and a father, the least integrated or assimilated person into Norway is the mother. And she starts to worry when the girls become teenagers that they're wearing skinny jeans and t-shirts, and she's afraid they would become too Norwegian. So she wonders what she can do to get them back into a more Somali way of living. And she goes to the local mosque and talks to the imam. And this imam says that he has a recipe. And that is a young, very good-looking Quran teacher that has a great reputation to get kids and teenagers back into the fold of Islam. So they hire him. And that is, according to the father, that is the start of the nightmare.
And this guy, this charismatic religious teacher, his name is Mustafa. And the girls also get involved with another conservative Muslim group. It's called Islamnet, right?
Yes. So it's kind of a step-by-step radicalization. It starts only with them being a bit more observant, praying, fasting, dressing differently. The mother at first is really happy because they throw away their jeans and their T-shirts and they stop going to parties and she doesn't need to fear any longer that they will start drinking or get boyfriends or anything. So she's quite happy. But then, as teenagers sometimes do, they go much further than their parents want. And that is an inspiration that they get through these organizations, the Islamnet, for instance, that is teaching these young teenagers to reject a Western way of life, to reject Norway, and that their only point of reference should be Islam and the Quran.
And interestingly, their brother, Ismail, goes in the opposite direction. He is taught by Mustafa, this charismatic religious teacher. And he asks him at one point if he supports Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab. And Mustafa says, oh, he doesn't have anything against them. And then Ismail, the brother, is horrified and tells his mom she doesn't do anything. So why do you think Ismail reacted so differently than the girls, than his sisters?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. First, he just finds this Quran teacher like pretentious. He doesn't like him. Like, and then later, he's quite disgusted by his message and warns the mother, who then just says that, you know, you probably heard wrong, because she wants to like this teacher because he's the one who gave her back her daughters. That's how she feels it, because as she's not assimilated into Norway, she's afraid to lose them to Norway. Whereas this boy, Ismail, he's a Muslim like them, but it's interesting how the girls become more and more conservative and he's losing his faith because he believes that what faith did to their sisters, that's there's something wrong with the religion as such. So he actually, in this process, becomes an atheist.
Interesting. So from as best as you could piece together, what was it about Syria and joining the jihad that attracted them so much? What were they looking for? What did they want to do?
They thought that this was what would make God happy, what would make Allah happy, and what would make him the most happy was if they died as martyrs. And if you died in that way, your soul would fly into the body of a green bird, and that green bird would be allowed to build a nest under the throne of Allah. So they're really moving towards this very, very extreme religious way of seeing the world. And this was the case for many of the girls who left from Europe and from America or from Canada, whereas the boys were often a bit different. Half of the boys, more or less, had a criminal record. They were street boys, how to say, with a history of theft or violence, drugs. And these were the young people who was going to inhabit the new state, the new caliphate.
But if you say that they wanted to die for the cause, how did they envision themselves dying? Like, were they going to die in the battlefield? Were they going to blow themselves up? What?
Well, their plan was actually to marry and become housewives and to facilitate the Islamic State in that way, because this new project, that's the first time young women were flocking to a war zone like that, because they envisioned that this was going to be a state that would work. Of course, it needs women because it needs children, it needs families, it needs to breed new fighters.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Norwegian journalist and author Åsne Serstad about her new book, Two Sisters, A Father, His Daughters, and Their Journey into the Syrian Jihad. Let's talk about the father now, Sadiq. So he goes off after them. He eventually makes it into Syria after going to Turkey and kind of sneaking through a fence and running and dodging bullets, and it's very dramatic.
Sadiq, only 3 days after they leave Norway, he takes the same journey, first down to Turkey, and then he crosses the border into Syria. And you can't travel around in Syria on your own in ISIS-held territory, because they would very likely think you're a spy or they accuse you of something. So you have to hook up with some militant groups. So he hooked up with the Nusra Front, which is the Syrian branch of Al-Qaeda. And they are kind of the good guys in this book. Everything's relative in a war zone. And they said they wanted to help Sadiq to rescue the girls if he paid them. So he had to pay for the guards. He had to pay for protection. He had to pay for, you know, cars and all that. But he was at first very successful. After a few weeks, he actually found the girls. The situation when he finds them becomes very dramatic. There's a shootout. One of the daughters gets injured. But he gets to see the oldest daughter, Ayan, and tells her that finally you're safe with me, with daddy. You can go home to me and mommy, and the nightmare is over. And she just looks at him and says, no, I can't, because I'm married now here, and this is my life down here.
Does she like it there? I mean, does she and Layla, they do communicate with their family, and they say, stop looking for us. We're enjoying it here. This is our life. We don't want to go home. Do they really feel that way, or are they being coerced?
Well, that is hard to know. I don't think they were forced to say it. I think there's a bit of self-delusion in it. But when you look at what they communicated to their parents and to the brother, and the fact that if they had wanted to be rescued, there were many chances for them to go home. But I think they were actually in love with their husbands. And I think a book like this can give a bit more nuances of why did the caliphate succeed for a while. Like, we in the media, you see all those ISIS fighters as monsters and just brutal thugs. But this is young people who tried to live as they see it, according to God's wish. Of course, now, if they're still alive, life is hell. Definitely, because ISIS has lost their territories. But for several years, they were living in Raqqa. They were bragging about having nice villas, never, ever bothering about the fact that these villas were stolen from those who had fled Syria or had been deported or had been killed by ISIS. But they were bragging about having everything for free, not having to work, nice villas with gardens and even pets. And so, of course, you might say that, did they really believe this? Well, it seemed to me that they actually did.
Let's talk about Sadiq and what he did, because you rely on him a lot to tell the story, and he's the chief character in your book. And yet, as you say in your book, he has a history of lying. He lies to the Norwegian police. He tells them the girls are kidnapped and want to be rescued when, as you just say, it doesn't appear that they did. He lies to the press. He made up all these stories that the press then printed that were made up to raise money so that he could keep paying his fixer and the bodyguards and all that. He lies to friends saying he's in Syria and working with the British Secret Service. So how did you feel about relying on him to tell a large part of this story when he has this history of fabrication?
That was a big drama, actually. I've written like 3 books, and that ended up as one. And when I met him for the first time, what he told me was that his daughters were kidnapped down in Syria, that they'd gone on their own, but they were desperate to be rescued, that they were hiding from their husbands and so on. And of course, I believed that, because who wouldn't believe that two Norwegian girls would want to escape the hellish situation or brutality of ISIS? So I actually believed that for 1.5 years. So I did a lot of research with that as a background. And then I do receive the chat logs between the two sisters and their brother. And then I realized that these girls have never wanted to come home, that this was just a big scammed. It was just a lie. And I was gathering more information. I didn't confront Sadiq right away because I was thinking, okay, what else is not right here? What else is not true? And then when I confronted him and I said, if you want me to write what you're telling me, you have no credibility. And then he was really angry. So we didn't speak for several months, actually, after that. It took time to get back together. And he never said, yes, I did lie about this and that. But he just said that, okay, whatever you don't have several sources on, we can't put in the book. So I had to describe the whole situation then in the book, all the different lies he had, not all of them, but some of them, just to show to the reader that this is a person who is, it seems like he felt forced to lie. And I think it makes him into a much more more interesting character. If he'd just been that very brave father who went down to this war zone to rescue his girls and then a grieving father too, that's fine. But then he's like, no, he's the brave and grieving father who can't live with the facts that his daughters have deceived him, that his daughters not only left without telling, fled from home, but when he met them, they chose a war zone over his, you know, house in Norway. So that was, he felt he failed as a father, as a husband, as a man. So it was easier for him to invent lots of, you know, rescue missions and so on, instead of just facing that truth that his daughter's will was not his own will.
As you say, the fortunes of ISIS have definitely declined. Do you know what's happened to them? Have you heard anything about what's happened to the girls and whether or not Sadiq is still trying to find them?
The last time they heard of them was November last year. They didn't call directly, but they heard through the father of another Norwegian girl who was down in Syria that they were together. They had then fled from Raqqa, but there's still pockets of ISIS control throughout Syria. So they might be in one of those zones, or they might be dead because there's been so many bombs here. So the parents don't even know if they're alive.
And you say their dad now lives in Somalia. What about the rest of the family?
Well, he lives a bit here and there, as does the rest of the family. So, I mean, no, Ismail, the young atheist, he's studying to become an engineer. And he has accepted, as he told me, that his sisters are no longer part of his life. Of course, parents can't really do that, but they also can't really continue life. They also have two smaller boys who are in school for the moment in Norway. But it's the whole family has kind of exploded. So these are also the implications of many families whose daughters and sons have left for the war zone, that they are going through very, very hard times.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a fascinating discussion. Appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me to your show.
Oh, my pleasure. That's Åsne Seierstad. She's a journalist and author of the new book, Two Sisters, A Father, His Daughters, and Their Journey into the Syrian Jihad. And she'll be here this Sunday. She'll be at the Los Angeles Times Book Festival. Warren Olney is here now. What's on this week's To the Point?
Well, we have two things on this week's To the Point. The first is an interview with Gina McCarthy, who is the former head of the EPA. We're going to talk to her about Scott Pruitt and what he's doing to try to dismantle the EPA. We don't talk to her. We'll talk to somebody from the Washington Post about the scandals that he's involved in. But we'll talk to McCarthy about whether he is, in fact, being effective at overturning all of the regulations that President Trump has cheered him for doing. And one of the interesting things she says is he doesn't know what he's doing, which is very interesting. That's... We're also going to talk with a real never-Trumper about James Comey and whether Comey has, in fact, damaged his own credibility by, as it were, getting down there in the swamp with the president.
The hands comment?
Indeed.
Okay. That's on To the Point this week. Download it. Get it. It's a podcast. Wherever you get your podcast, KCRW.com is one place. Coming up, a feature film about French director Jean-Luc Godard, made by another celebrated director, the Academy Award-winning director of The Artist. He'll be here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In 1967, the great French film director Jean-Luc Godard married a young actress who starred in his movie La Chinoise. Anne Wiaziemski was 20 years old. Godard was 37. Their relationship didn't last long. In 1968, Godard supported violent student protests in Paris that called for Marxist revolution. Godard himself became a Marxist, or maybe a Maoist. He started making Marxist movies and even disavowed all the films he was famous for. He called them bourgeois. Wiaziemski wrote two books about their relationship, and one of them has become the basis of a new movie by French filmmaker Michel Hazanavicius. He won an Academy Award in 2012 for his black and white silent film, The Artist. His latest is called Godard, Mon Amour, and Michel Hazanavicius is in the studios now. Hello.
Hello.
So Jean-Luc Godard, was he a filmmaker that you grew up studying? Was he a big influence on you? What did you think of him?
Well, no, it was not a big influence. I mean, not especially. He was a big influence for all the people who made movies after him. But it was not a special influence. I never worshipped him. And I like his early works, really.
Like Breathless.
Breathless, Pierrot le Fou, Vivre sa vie. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of...
Pre-1968.
Yes, exactly. And these movies were really charming and inventive and creative and funny as well and very intense. And he worked with beautiful actors. And even if they were not conventional movies, they are great. After 68, in his Maoist period, it's a little bit more obscure and tough and confusing for me. But... I never intended to make a movie about him, actually. It's just that I read the book written by Anne Wiaziemski, and I fell in love with the characters and the story and the context and everything. So I thought there was a good movie to make here.
What is her point of view? What is her tone in writing the book?
I think she has the right distance, because when she wrote the book, she was like 65 or something, uh-huh. And she's talking about a story... that happened when she was 19, 18. And she respected the young woman she was, but she knows and she's aware of a lot of things now. So I really like the distance she had with everything.
So she is really young and nubile, and he is kind of, well, he's older. He's not terribly old, but he's a lot older than she, and he seems a lot more troubled by what's happening in Paris at that time.
Well, I think he accumulates a lot of crises. Maybe he has like a midlife crisis, he has an artistic crisis, and he lives in a country was going through a huge crisis. So yeah, she's much younger, she's a student, she's more like an observer, and she looks at her husband, because they get married, and he loses himself, and she just can witness it.
Well, in a way, it seems that he's kind of mad at her, in a way, for maybe embodying this youth that he doesn't have any longer, that he really wants to be a part of, this youthful rebellion, this youthful energy. Yeah. And then, ironically, she's not really interested in the youthful rebellion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true.
He's more interested in it than she is.
Yeah, I think he's because when he started, like 10 years ago, 10 years before, he made that movie Breathless, and it was really a revolution in movies history. And then 10 years after, he's not revolutionary anymore. He's making a movie called La Chinoise, who's supposed to be revolutionary. It's about revolution, and nobody really cares about it. And that makes him crazy, I guess. And suddenly... I think he tries to find a way to be revolutionary again. This is a notion very important for him. And then the revolution comes into the country and he goes too far with it and he becomes a Maoist, very radical, and he really radicalizes himself.
And he is, you portray him, and maybe this is true, I don't know him personally, as really abrasive and unpleasant as a human being.
Yeah.
Is he?
I don't know him. No, but no, I'm joking. Well, he never pretended he was sympathetic, and yeah, all yeah. the people who know him would. Nobody says he's very sympathetic. I think he can be funny and charming, and at the beginning of the movie, he's like that. I mean, he is charming in a way, but when he became like a lot of people, actually, when you become radical, you lose your sense of humor,
and
you can and you can see it in the movie he made. Actually, the movie are less charming, really. So yeah, he's not a pleasant person for sure, but I think it's more or less the truth. Yes.
So talk a little bit about how you shot the film, because it feels like pop fresh, yeah. like a Godard film would be. Did you want it to look like he would have shot that film?
No, he would never have shot a movie like this, because it's a period movie. It's full of extras, the characters, the story. It's not at all his style. But I used his motifs, that kind of aesthetic. And I put him in his own aesthetic. And because I put him in some very difficult situations sometimes, I make fun of him, I'm ironic with him. So the form of the movie itself pays homage to his work. So it was kind of a balance. It was a way to show his positive way, what he brings to cinema and how free he was and how free he is. He's still free.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking with Michel Hassanavicius. He's the director of a new movie called Godard, Mon Amour. Okay, let's also talk about Naked Women, because you have a
yes.
lot of...
It's too bad we're on radio.
Because you have a lot of shots of your main character naked.
Yeah.
And are you kind of making fun of that trope in Godard movies, in a
well,
lot of
Well, not
French
especially
movies?
Godard movies. There's some nudity in Godard movies, but in a lot of movies, actually. I usually don't make nude scenes and never love scenes. I never do it. And usually when I see it, except when it's like the subject of the movie, like a Lars von Trier movie or something. But usually I don't buy it. I see actors pretending they are making love. I think it's stupid. Well, and but I thought it was really part of the period, that kind of movies. And also it was really in their story, because he was considering her as an object. And he was filming her. He always filmed women and the body of women like objects. And I think it's really constitutive of their story, of their love story. And also I wanted, because the movie is like a dramedy, I think it's fun. I think it's a funny movie, but still the story is very tragic. And I mean, it's a sad ending love story. And the bed was like a very important set. There's a lot of things happening in the bed, so the bed is important. But I also do. I'm having fun about the nude scenes in the
Yeah, because there's one point he's nude and he's addressing the camera full frontal, saying, "You know, why is it that directors always shoot naked bodies?"
Or something. Exactly. And actually, she's naked in the movie. But there's also two actors, male actors, naked in the movie. So I mean, I try to be fair, to be okay.
Equal opportunity.
Yeah.
Nudity. So she, the real Anne, she died last year.
Yeah.
Did she get a chance to see your movie?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, of course. And she was one of the first person to watch the movie. It was almost, the cutting was almost finished. And what happened when she accepted to sell me the rights of the book, because she declined many offers before she accepted. And she accepted because I told her I would do a comedy. And she was very sensitive to that. And so when she accepted, she said, "Don't send me your script. Don't show me anything. When the movie's done, you show me. If I like it, I'll put my name on it." And so she came, and she was really, really moved by the movie. She was really, it was really nice and touching to see her as moved as she was. And she really recognized Godard. She thought the portrait was like really, really good. Mm. And we went to the Cannes Festival with her, and we were on the red carpet with her, and it was she knew she was sick at that point, and I think she was. It was really, really intense for her to go back to the Cannes Festival with that movie, telling her own story with Godard, and yes, it was very touching to share this with her.
Yeah, well, because he famously, and this is in your movie, he rejects the Cannes Film Festival. It's too bourgeois.
He rejects everything. I mean, really, I think on his grave they will write like, "No, no way, I'm not dead." I don't know. He's in opposition to everything. He's an anti guy.
Yeah. Has he seen the movie?
I don't know. I haven't received any texts from him. Like, congrats. I love your movie.
Did you tell him you were doing this?
Yeah, I sent him a letter, actually. The first day when we started the production, the first day of prep, I sent him a letter just to inform him that I was doing this. And not asking for his authorization, but just to inform him. He never answered, and that's okay. That's cool.
You weren't afraid he was going to come and get angry or
hey, anything. He's 88. I'm 50. No, I was not afraid.
No, I'm you
joking.
Could take him?
No, I'm not joking. No, I'm joking. Actually, he has an army of people who worship him. And they did the job for him, actually. the critics?
Really?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's some really fanatic critics with him. There's a cultural diktat around him. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so if you're not... if you don't follow them, they want to kill you. And some critics are like this. And what I did actually is I humanized him. That's what they don't like, the critics who are talking about, because he's not supposed to be a human being. Because human being can fail. And this is not... Godard can't fail. Godard is like Chuck Norris. He's like, he can do everything.
You're equating him with Chuck Norris.
And Godard and Chuck Norris are exactly the same kind of characters. And actually, I think even if he really acts like a jerk, like an asshole, and he can be very mean and... He thinks he's revolutionary, but in the same time, he's very bourgeois. He wants his wife to be close to him and that kind of stuff. But still, in my opinion, he's also very heroic because he decided to do something and he did it against everything and against everybody. He did what he decided to do. And it's kind of heroic.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
That's Michel Hassanavicius. He's the director of the Academy Award-winning film The Artist. His latest is called Godard, Mon Amour. It comes out this Friday at the Lemley Royal. Christian Bordahl is here now.
Hey there, Madeline. Well, at the top of the show today, you talked about the UC Berkeley poll that found, among other things, that 49% of Californians support temporarily banning people from Muslim-majority countries.
Right.
Robert Grenada says, it ain't my percentage of California. Glenn Searle is shocked and disappointed. He says, it feels like humanity is on the brink of the next social evolution, but we keep being stopped by these people who are overwhelmed by fear. Ralph Acosta says, when I went to protest the ban here at San Diego Airport with about 4,000 others, it was the first time the city had ever witnessed something like that in its history. All the local media were in shock. It felt like the whole state was behind us. So empowering, or so I thought. Sad face.
All right. Thank you for that.
Sure.
And thanks for all your comments. Listeners, keep them coming at Twitter, @KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.